RDT Systems, the Wrap 1400 or 1400 if you like doing it that way, but it's the Wrap 1400. It's a collar that is super reliable, ready to rock, and it's super handy because you can hold it in your hand while you're shooting your shotgun during duck season. So it's a cool unit for you and your dog come hunting season so that you've got control over any situation. Anything the dog throws at you during the hunt is right there, easy and accessible. Bingo, bango, bongo. If you don't want that one, check out the H2O 1820. It's the DT Systems and it's dog tested, dog tough. All right, baby. Gunner Kennels. Man, one of the things that I love about Gunner Kennels is they're thinking about our older hunting buddies. Old Buck, he hangs out in a Gunner Kennel when he goes to and fro. And in his, we've got the ortho pad. He's got the old joints. And even if your dog's not old like Buck, you just want a little bit of added protection as you're rolling down the road to keep that dog from bouncing around a little bit. So the ortho pad, super huge. If you got a younger dog that may dig a little bit, maybe chew a little bit, that performance pad is going to be clutch as well. So check it out. It's the full kit brought to you by Gunner Kennels, always innovating our industry and always keeping your dog safe. Slide the DMs if you'd like to learn more about getting you and your dog into a Gunner Kennel. Have you wondered if you wanted to force fetch your dog? Maybe you think your dog's too soft. Maybe you're too nervous to screw, quote unquote, screw your dog up. Let me help you. I built a start to finish course with different dogs, different breeds, and different personalities from start to finish to show you how that you and your dog can do it successfully and easy. Jump in, links in the description. We'd be happy to help you. Let's go. Let's set goals and get you and your dog where you want to be this duck season.
What's going on, everybody, for another episode of Lone Ducks Gun Dog Chronicles. Real quick, I want to give a big old shout out to our sponsors. Big thank you to Yukon Nuba, the food that fuels our dogs on the road, in the field, in the blind. We have been messing around with the different formulas from puppy, adult, to the 30-20 sporting blend. And I got to tell you, I'm pleased with coats, I'm pleased with teeth, I'm pleased with performance. So if you're interested and want to give it the old Yuke try, go find yourself a bag and feed that monster of yours. Next up is Gunner Kennels, the safest, most reliable kennel on the market. They have plenty of other options as well. Right now, my old dog, Buck, who's pushing 10 years old in the month of March, he likes to snooze in his Gunner Kennel with the orthopedic dog bed, which is just helpful for his joints. You know, he's worked really hard over his life, and he's got aches and pains, and that bed is the ticket. So check that bad boy out. And lastly, Waypoint Outdoor Collective. You know they do our analytics and you know they help us stay connected with you. So thank you, Waypoint Outdoor Collective. And now tonight, I'm excited to introduce you all to Tom Keir. We met Tom at the Yukon Nuba HQ back in May, I think. And we sat at the table and BS'd about dogs and New England lifestyle, playing lacrosse. But the cool part is Tom is not only a well-renowned outdoor writer, but he is a grouse machine and woodcock connoisseur. So, Tom, thank you so much for joining our show. Do me a favor. Tell everybody a little bit about yourself.
Well, guys, I really appreciate you having me on, especially with busy schedules and the holidays, et cetera. So thanks very much. I grew up in Connecticut on a dairy farm right in the middle of what used to be the Connecticut River Valley Firearms companies. I was born in Meriden, so I have a penchant for shooting Parkers because that was our local gun, but Marlin was 2 miles away in North Haven. Mossberg and Winchester were 9 miles away in New Haven. Colt was just up the road in Hartford, about 18 miles away. And then you had Ruger and Smith & Wesson in just over the border in Massachusetts above the tobacco fields. And my first, you know, so it was a different era. That's when, you know, and I think that was something that we had touched upon at the Yukonuba event was, you know, how landscapes have changed. And, you know, even in the Northeast, it used to be a lot more rural than it was. So just, you know, walking down the road, walking out the back door, it was easy to hunt. It was really easy to fish, and it's not that way anymore. My first dog was an Irish setter, and she was the best dog I've ever hunted over for about 5 minutes. She was a line bird. And I poke no fun at the current Irish setters and the red setters. But she was 1969. It was, you know, the too much line breeding, a lot of the show stock to bring out some of the better characteristics, you know. So she looked great. Ran great for 5 minutes, and if she was on a bird back then, we had a lot of, you know, grouse, woodcock, and wild pheasant. She'd be perfect, but after that, she'd catch, you know, some scent, and, you know, we didn't have e-collars back then, so she'd be gone for a day, maybe two, sometimes three, and come back vomiting and defecating and just be a total mess. And we wound up having four of them. So
no way.
Yeah.
Really?
I think that, you know, I started becoming interested in training dogs and working with dogs to understand them, because I just couldn't understand the, you know, the first, second, third, and fourth dogs that we had, because, you know, they were just too much line breeding.
So the fifth time's the charm. What was, like, what do you think the difference was on the fifth one?
I switched to English setters.
There you go.
So do you think that line breeding was intelligence, lack thereof, or talk to me a little bit about your methodology, your thought behind that a little.
They weren't dogs that we were breeding. My late dad was a soldier, so he was, you know, they were dogs that he'd pick up. He was a big gun collector, big shooter. Big fisherman and hunter, but, so there were dogs that he would pick up from other guys who, you know, you'd always hear it. It's, this is the great litter coming out. This is the best litter. And it's, you know, the genetics, as you guys know, are just critical to a dog's success. You know, the better the genetics, the easier the training, and the better the performance. And, you know, it was just that combination of show and field stock that was, you know, done to make them look better and perform less. So, you know, breeding is something I had covered that in a piece for the Rough Grouse Society a while back, I think maybe a year or two ago, for Matt Soberg, who was the editor, and it was called Backyard Breeders. And there's breeding is really important. It's you know, there's a saying that just because you have a great apple pie and I have a great Boston cream pie doesn't mean that if we put them together we'll have a phenomenal pie. And I think a lot of people look at that, and that's where some mistakes are made. But for the guys that really look at coefficient of inbreeding and overall health and performance, it's a real skill. It's a real knack, and there's a little bit of voodoo science that gets thrown in for luck. But, you know, the guys that breed, you know, up your way, Pete Flanagan, you know, Grouse Ridge Kennels, yep. You know, four generations of guys that really knew what they were doing.
Yeah, that's actually where my English setter is out of. She's from Majority Grouse Ridge Lines, and I got her from a gentleman, maybe you know of him, his name's Styles Bridges.
I know the name.
Yep, he's up near Ogdensburg, up in that area, Messina maybe, and he and the Grouse Ridge gentleman were running field trials together, and, you know, so Andy's got a lot of that line going back, and I'll tell you what, I'll be very honest with everybody. She's a meat dog to me, and I've got a lot of client dogs, so she might get a few sessions a week with actual training, but natural talent and desire to work is through the roof.
And, you know, that biddable temperament, you know, the big heads with a lot of bird smarts, you know, with the males running about 40, 45 pounds, the females running about 30, 35 pounds. They're real athletic dogs. They've got good stamina, you know, great noses, excellent drive. You know, there's a lot to be said for breeding by professionals.
Yeah, I agree. She's a good walk behind dog. Where Kevin's dog is still very young, but likes to run big. And we got her from a friend of mine in Ohio, and she breeds for that to hunt quail in big country. So Kevin's dog is learning how to rein it in a little bit in the grouse woods, where Andy is, you know, 50, 60 yards in front of me, works back to 20, gets back out there, and man, I'll tell you, this year she's turned it on.
How old is she?
Good question. I think two. This is her second season.
She's like two and a half.
She's my meat dog. And I got her at 6 months last June.
Yep.
So she's coming up on two.
That's great.
Yeah, absolutely turning it on. So, but again, like you said, that comes from breeding and natural instinct and someone who knows what they're looking for trying to pull that out of a dog. And I'm sure other people might hunt behind her too and be like, oh, this dog doesn't hunt big enough, or they may not like some of the style, but she, for me, is finding grouse and woodcock and hanging on to them until I can get there.
And, you know, matching your hunting style to the type of dog that you're going to hunt is, to my mind, real critical. You know, I see a lot of folks that are, you know, whether they're reading online or they're watching YouTubes or reading about particular lineages, and, you know, they get a logical view of what they want out of a dog, and they're disappointed when they actually get the dog from that particular breeding. You know, some, you know, when it comes to cover dogs, some of them will cast inside of 30 yards. I like them to be a little bit more athletic. I like them casting into inside a bell range, you know, which is, depending on the wind, somewhere around 100, 125, 150 yards. And then you have your performance dogs that, you know, I've seen a lot of pointers and some setters that are out in the 200, 2 1/4, 250. So, yard range. So when you have dogs of that scale, you know, casting between 30 and 250 yards, you really have a lot of different dogs to pick from. So matching your hunting style with that dog, I think it adds a lot of happiness and a lot of fun to your hunt and to your training. Because if you have, if you move slower and you have a dog that's way out in front, it's tough to get up. You guys know that. It's tough to move 250 yards in a grouse cover.
Right. Now, real quick, you touched on something that maybe some of our listeners don't know or understand or have heard of, but cover dog. Can you describe that to people?
Yeah, they're you know, it's it could be any type of breed. It could be, well, you know, Bob Whaley, former owner of Elhue Kennels and Genesee Brewing, you know, had a great shooting dog that would adjust itself to the terrain. A lot of the cover dogs are used to being able to navigate a really dense environment, you know, so you'll have all age dogs that are used to soft grasses, you know, Johnson grass, love grass, wire grass, that they can move through it real quickly. They'll run an edge, they catch scent, and then they'll move in to, say, a covey of quail. And they're built to run bigger. The cover dog is designed to be able to athletically move through bull briars, raspberries, you know, primary and secondary growth like alders, popple, white birch, aspen, and any of the other, you know, briars and brambles that are inherent in a primary and secondary growth, a young growth forest. So they have to be a little bit more athletic, but they have to know their way around the terrain. And that's a skill that I see when some of my friends that might be from Kansas or from North Carolina, when they bring their dogs up to hunt, it takes the dogs a few days to adjust to the different situation.
Sure. And that cover dog is a trial, which would be, you know, first, second, third, fourth type of thing, correct?
There are cover dog trials for, you know, cover dog specialists, whether they're pointers or setters. Most of them are pointers and setters, but you'll see a lot of other cover dogs that are versatile dogs that are used in the grass woods, like short hairs. I've been seeing a lot more Vizslas recently, you know, but they're pointing dogs.
Mm-hmm. And they're working for grouse.
Yep. They have grouse. They're looking to pin the grouse. The reason that speed is so desirable is that the combined with bird smarts is that, you know, the dog can actually pin the bird. But, you know, if you have a slow moving dog, well, as you guys know, grouse don't like to fly. You know, when they take to the air, they can become victims of avian predators like a goshawk. So they like to run. And because they're running through the thick cover, you know, blowdowns, brush, briars, you know, they'd prefer to stay on the ground. And if you have a dog that moves real fast, that knows, that has good bird smarts and can figure out the direction that the bird is going in, they will move quickly and pin the bird. So they come up upon the bird and the bird sits. It won't run out and it doesn't take flight. And that's called pinning the bird. And that's a super desirable characteristic in a grouse dog.
Well, so I would pair that with also respecting the bird's space so they're not too close and bump the bird.
Well, you're exactly right. You know, if you have a dog that, and I'm working a young puppy that's out of Thor Kane and Jim Chambers' recent litter from last year. And, you know, he's 13 months right now and getting the hang of it. He was hell on woodcock this fall and good with grouse. He's getting better at the grouse game, but he's trying to do exactly what you were talking about, which is figuring out how much pressure they can put on a bird.
Right. In your opinion, because I would consider myself a novice at this end of the game, it's got to be just bird contacts. It's not training. You know, I can work her and pop a pigeon or something if she gets too close to the pigeon, but as far as a wild bird, that's going to teach the dog.
As you guys both know, a pen-raised bird that's either put in a cage or released on a launcher or even put out in the field, they behave differently than a wild bird. So I try to train as much as possible just on wild birds. In the spring, when the woodcock start migrating back, we'll start running dogs in March and April. We lay off when we start seeing the sky dances because that's indicating that the breeding's around the corner. So we'll pull them out. And the same thing for grouse. But the more wild bird contacts you can get with your dog, the better wild bird dog they're going to be.
Sure. Sure. So, going to that point, you know, here where we're from, we're still on like scouting missions trying to find birds. You know, we've been lucky enough to find a few little hot spots, but we'll also walk miles and not get a contact. I'm assuming where you like to hunt, there's a higher density?
Yes, no. You know, urban sprawl's been a big problem in the last probably 30 years, 40 years. Started seeing it in the early 70s. Been seeing a lot of anti-hunting sentiment with we lost four covers that were two great, two of my best grouse covers and two decent woodcock covers to postings. There were some, four properties were sold to folks that were from away, and the first thing that they did is post them. So that's a frustration. But the other part of running your dog in the spring on wild birds is that you can scout out other areas. So I'll run the dogs in the spring, lay off once they start to nest. And then in August, usually around second week in August, third week in August, I'll start running the dogs again to get ready for the season. So I try my best to have my covers figured out of which ones are productive, which ones are marginal, which ones are, overgrown and aren't supporting as many birds as in the past. And then I'll look for flight covers, which are mostly around, big fields that run into river bottoms, because those will fill up in, second, third week in August, October, when the flights are on. So that way, I'm spending more of my hunting time, my hunting season hunting, as opposed to looking for spots. And it's better for the dogs. They get year round work. They're getting wild bird contacts instead of released birds. And, it's setting me up for a successful fall.
Sure. Now, how many dogs do you own?
Right now we've got three. We had to put one down last November, and looking at the puppy came. The puppy was gonna be the fourth. We had to put another dog down 2 years ago. So both of those were a little unexpected. Cancer 2 years ago was a 7-year-old dog. Last year was a 10-year-old dog. So I thought I might have another 2 years out of her. So we've got three and are looking at a puppy for some time. Litter should be whelped around June.
Where are you getting that puppy from?
From Pennsylvania. I'm a big fan of the Pennsylvania dogs. Thor Kane has taken over Dick Brenneman's spot for Dick Brenneman and Bob Watts were cover dog setters out of State College, and they're just phenomenal breeders. They're big time field trialers. They've consistently produced excellent dogs for 50 years.
Wow.
Jim Chambers is another real solid breeder. Roger Hoover is another guy that I've gotten two dogs from. So I tend to look for some of the smaller private litters, when I see the genetics that I like that are going to be paired.
Gotcha. And do you have a personal preference on looks?
Not particularly. I like a dog to look good, but I'm more interested in their performance and their nose and if they've got good bird smart and if they're in the right size. I like that the males in the 40-45 pound range for the setters and the females 30-35. So they've got to have good conformation, but looks are. If they're great looking dogs, then that's a bonus. But
sure.
I'm really looking at the performance.
Well, that's how I try and describe to people as well. You're going to have a great family member and you're going to have a great dog no matter what. But you want performance first, because if they sleep on the couch and don't want to go swimming, then what's the worth if it's just good looking? So, look for performance, and then you're going to create a great everything else next. But I guess where I was thinking is the setters kind of come in all different color schemes, and I didn't know if there was just like, oh, that one's the one, or just good looking in terms of like my female's black and white with a little bit of brown ticking and the little buttons on her eyes with the brown, and Kevin's is white and orange. I just didn't know if there was like, I always lean towards the white and orange or whatever.
No, I've had, blue Beltons, orange Beltons, had tricolors. Probably if I if I had to pick, I'm a fan of the tricolor. My daughter's dog that we lost a couple years ago, we used to call him the Zeus of setters because he is just stunningly gorgeous. Half mask, he was a tricolor. He was a male, 55 pounds, you know, perfect tail set, 90 degrees, big head, had the wide muzzle, which is great for respiration. It circulates the air a little bit better so that, you know, as opposed to the smaller muzzle, so that their endurance is better, you know, but, you know, so if you can get a stunningly good looking dog like Albert was, and have a performance dog, then, you know, you've kind of,
good.
Oh yeah,
absolutely.
But given the option of a good looking dog or a good performing dog, I'll take the good performing dog every day of the week and twice on Sunday.
Absolutely.
You know now, that.
Yeah, me too. Me too. Now, when you're working a puppy, you know, so you've got you said 13-month-old, you know, learning the ropes. When you get him, this is where I think the retriever world and the pointing world sort of differs, where a lot of the pointing world, and I want your opinion on it, they tend to, quote unquote, allow the dog to mature and allow the dog way more time than, like, for instance, some of my buddies run NAVDA, and their year-and-a-half-old dogs aren't doing a quarter of what my six-month-old retriever puppy is doing because we're starting them off right and teaching all along the way, not kind of going raw and just letting them be a dog, if you will, for so long. How do you try and develop a young setter?
You know, that's an excellent question. And, you know, from looking at social media, I see that there are a lot of younger trainers and handlers that are trying to move their dog along very quickly. And I remember I had made one post on my wife's dog that's from Buck Carrico's last litter. A lot of had Grouse Ridge Reroy, Penn Star, Full Blast. You know, it was just a very well-bred dog. His name's Rebel. And he came along really quickly. My friend Roger Hoover shot the first woodcock over his point that he did perfectly at 5 months. Now, that's the fastest dog that I've ever had come around.
Sure.
So I had posted that on, I think on Facebook, just as, you know, just a first point over Rebel. Roger Hoover killed the first bird, and, you know, got some real snotty messages about what are you waiting for so long? And, you know, my dog is steady to wing, shot and drop at 3 months.
Jeez.
And, you know, some of that stuff, you know, and it concerns me that there are a lot of other people that are all watching, you know, these dialogues. So they seem to think that if you have a dog that's 6 months old and it's not broke, that you're doing something wrong. And my experience has been that some dogs come along faster than others. He was really fast. Cider, my puppy, I shot the first bird over him when he did everything absolutely right he was 12 months.
Yeah.
So he was a little slower. And Rowdy that we put down last year, she was slower and she was 15 months. But, you know, I think not rushing the dog and, you know, letting the dog be a puppy, let them get the basics, you know, get your yard work done, make sure that you have a connection with the dog, that the dog is obedient, recall is good, and let them knock some birds, start to staunch them up, and, you know, take your time. It'll
happen.
What's
your methodology? What's your methodology for making them more staunch?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'd I'd been pretty much using the Delmar Smith method for the most part, you know, check chords with a half hitch. And I was talking with Thor Kane and Jim Chambers about it. Cider, the puppy, is he's fast. He's real aggressive and just lives to hunt. So I've been having some problems with him on, you know, standing his birds. Mm-hmm. So, you know, putting the belly band on, using two collars, one e-collar on the neck for control and handle, and then the second one around a belly band for staunchness has been working. The half hitch around with a check cord has been working. And putting him in more situations where he can be successful. I find that rather than having it be so random and, you know, he wins a bird, he locks up, the bird walks or the bird moves and he rushes in to flush, that if I can manage the situation a lot better, I'm starting to see better results out of it.
So here's my question from a trainer's point of view. You're doing that all on wild birds?
I'll let them knock wild birds, and when they start to stop to flush, I know that I can start putting more training pressure on them. If they're just, and so they will naturally go forward and, you know, they'll run over birds and they get excited and they put the birds up. But when they start stopping to flush, stopping at the flush, I know I could start moving towards the next steps. And that's when I'll start running them with a check cord. Then I'll get some, and I'll bring them into areas like, you know, woodcock are great training birds, particularly because there are certain parts of every cover that always hold birds. So I will bring the young dogs into those areas where I'm real certain that there's going to be one, two, or three birds within maybe a 2 or 3 acre patch. And I can run them with a check cord and be present so that when they point, I'm there, so that we're not just prospecting. You know, it's a little bit more deliberate.
Right. Yeah.
And then, and then I'll move on to, you know, the release birds.
Gotcha. So that's where, like, I guess, again, as I would consider myself more of a novice at it, it's I'm using homing pigeons and will develop the point that way. And if they creep in, I'll pop the pigeon under my control where I know where that is planted. And I know if they're overrunning it and, you know, trying to bump it or, you know, give them time. And then I'll overlay with the check cord and I can have a little more control over it. Mainly because I don't have the resource of wild birds and the time to go and just say, all right, you know, I'm going to go hunt this cover with five dogs.
You know where I see the difference is, though, Bob, is you're doing it from a professional manner in the sense of people are paying for you to have it done, and I want it done in a few months, and you don't go get it done, where if Tom is looking to have a dog for the next 12 years, he wants it done right and is okay with being patient, things like that. Does that make sense? Or at least that's what I'm hearing.
Yeah, I think you're right. And Tom, I think you'd jump in on that.
I think you guys are both right. I mean, how many dogs do you guys have in your kennel? I'll tell you, it's a lot more than my three right now, normally four.
Yeah, yeah. No, yeah, we have 20 to 24 dogs, and most of them are retrievers. So, you know, to do five pointers, I've got to have my pigeons lined up in the field and plan them out and run them.
So you've got 6 to 7 time, depending on, you know, how many dogs you have in for training or if you've just had a litter. You know, you've got 6 to 7 times the number of dogs that I do.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So you have a lot more training that you're doing on a daily, weekly, monthly, quarterly, annually, you know, level than I am. I can really drill down and focus on my dogs. And the older dogs, they don't, you know, the older dogs that have a lot more experience will get a lot more conditioning work than the younger dogs that, you know, that need to learn the basics and then to move on to, you know, being steady to wing, steady to shot, steady to drop. So I tend to focus a lot more of my training effort on the younger dogs because the older dogs have a lot more experience.
Yeah, good point. Do you force shot your dogs so they'll deliver the bird to you, or do you just go get it?
I think that it's an important characteristic to have a dog that will point dead. It's desirable. I think that that's a must-do command, you know, that the dog, after point, after shot, after the bird drops, the dog has to, at a minimum, point dead. It can't just go on and start looking for another bird to point. Some of my, all of the dogs I've had will retrieve grouse, quail, and pheasant. It's taken some time with some of them. The woodcock has been a little bit tricky. There's that old adage that a lot of dogs just don't like to pick up woodcock. Mm-hmm. So I'll work on some force fetching, but, you know, again, I'm a hunter. I'm not a trialer. I'm not a pro trainer. So it's, they have to point dead. And if they'll fetch the bird, then that's a desirable characteristic.
Yeah, that's a bonus. But at least you're finding the game so you don't have to go look for it.
Correct.
Yeah, that's smart. I like that.
Tom, I was going to say.
Go ahead, Bob.
That's fine.
Nope, you're up.
Well, I wanted to hear about, a while ago now, I guess, you had talked about your first dog that was an Irish Setter. Do you remember going out on your first hunt with him? What was that like?
Well, you know, I mean, you guys are dog men, so used to do a lot of deer hunting when I was younger. I haven't deer hunted in a long time. Like to turkey hunt. If I miss some days during the turkey season, it's not a problem. But, you know, I don't miss a day during bird season.
Really?
And I don't miss many days during waterfowl season. And it's because of the dog.
Right.
So, you know, do I like to shoot birds? Absolutely, we all do. But I like to shoot birds because it's the reward for the dog that has done the job properly. You know, so when a dog is casting, starting to get birdie, locks up on point, and I go in and flush the bird, you know, I expect to kill as many of those. Do I shoot 100%? No, of course not. I miss a lot. But my effort is, you know, 110% to kill those birds because the dog has done its job. I don't really care about the tailgate shots. I like to eat birds. But it's really, you know, the dog work that kind of flips my switch. And, you know, be honest with you, I have never been so proud as when I grabbed a shotgun and cut the dog loose. And I've never been so miserable as I did when the dog ran off and, you know, I didn't know what to do. So, and I think that's what hooked me though, in kind of a weird way. If it was too easy, I probably wouldn't be so fanatical about dogs.
Yeah. I remember, it's funny that you mentioned, you know, the first dog that set the tone and would run away and all the issues. Our first family dog was a chocolate lab, and by all intents and purposes, he was the best dog we ever had, but also the worst dog. Didn't come when he was called, would steal our winter hats and gloves off us and run away. You know, just a bastard. But he was so good at being a family member. And I remember, you know, walking him on leash down the road, you know, taking him for a walk, and he wanted to get home, and he drugged me on my belly all the way home. And it was like, I was probably like 8, and I cried, and I told my dad, I go, I hate him. You know, why can't he be good like so-and-so's dog, who can be off leash and hang out with us and just pal around the neighborhood? And it stuck in my brain when I got my first hunting dog that I don't know how far I can take him, but I want to take him somewhere and make him the best I can. And then it spiraled into now, you know, my business and my lifestyle and a podcast and traveling the country doing this stuff. But that first dog who had things I couldn't figure out and didn't know how to do that made me want to do it better. And every dog I get, I want it to be better than the last one. And that kind of rung true with it. So
I had a horse like that. It was a barn rat. The further away from the barn, that it was a Morgan. It was a big Morgan. It was a 15.3. And, but the further away from the barn that we went, the slower the horse went. And, you know, you turn around and as soon as it sees the barn, you know, it's like the Kentucky Derby.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But, you know, so taking the first dog out, for that first run, it was at, our neighbor's farm, Mr. Beaumont, and he had a, you know, he had, registered Holsteins like we did, and he had a big, cornfield, and there were wild pheasant there, and I'd asked him if, you know, I'd swapped out work for him, so I'd buck hay in the summer and he'd let me hunt in the fall. And I took the dog out and, you know, had the bell on, no e-collars, no beeper collars, just a lead. She was healing great. Got to the corn, you know, saw a couple pheasant, cut her loose, popped two shells in, was walking. She was casting great. Everything was good for about 5 minutes. And then I saw her headed for the tree line. And, that's where there were usually a couple of whitetail. And I was whistling her back and she wasn't listening. And she was gone. She came back the next day. I thought I lost her. You know, I think I was 11 years old and, you know, terrified that I was going to get whooped up by my dad for losing my dog. So it was not good. And then she came back and, you know, vomiting and skinny. And, you know, we went back and did it the next day.
There you go. Do you remember the first hunt with a good dog? Was it somebody else's or something that set the tone where it's like, I want one like that?
I don't know that there was any one dog that really, you know, made me think twice. But I remember seeing my neighbor a couple miles away had a Weimaraner that was a really good dog. But his dog's name was Liz, and I used to call it Liz the Wonder Dog because we always wondered what dog was going to show up, the good one or the not good one. But I remember seeing, you know, some glimpses of brilliance with Liz on the good days. And then, you know, just started looking around at other guys that had setters, and there were a lot of labs around. And just started noticing that there were different, I guess what I first noticed is that there are different levels of dogs. You know, there are poor dogs, they're average dogs, they're good dogs, they're great dogs, they're exceptional dogs. But I think that it comes down, what always struck me is that, you know, it's a, genetics are of critical importance, as you both know. But I think that it's, you can take an average dog, and if you spend time with that dog and are training by a method, that you can really bring that dog along. You can bring that dog further along than if you're only working with them, you know, once a month.
Sure. Absolutely. It's anything in life. You want to get more fit, you got to go to the gym more than once a month.
Right.
Absolutely. Well, and also that partially too is genetic. You know,
yep.
With genes, you're going to stay fit.
Hold on, I'm going to yell at a puppy for scratching. Quiet. Lay down.
Old Quinn, she's getting a little diggy. So that's
where after you've I've gone through a bunch of dogs that have been average and have spent a lot of time with them to bring out their best qualities, and they've performed far better than they would have if I only trained, you know, once a month. You know, we're fortunate where we are now is that we have about 75 acres of conservation land behind our house. So we're running the dogs every day, and that's a blessing. Because if I lived in a city or, you know, in a small to medium sized town, I wouldn't be able to do that. So I think having access to open space where you can train regularly, where it's easy, it's something, you know, instead of taking lunch break, I'll go and run the dogs. At the end of the day, instead of having a beer, I'll go run the dogs and then I'll have a beer, you know? So being able to do it regularly is important, I think. And that's when it gets you to the point on the genetics, that once you're doing it on a regular basis and you're bringing your average dogs and to an elevated position like a good dog, then you really want to start looking at the genetics to get a great dog. Because how many dogs of excellent genetics do you see that don't get worked much?
Oh, too many.
And that's a bummer.
Yeah. It's a waste. They'll come back chubby and sleeping on a couch and pent up, and, you know, and it takes a while to get them back.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. To take this conversation somewhere a little different, I want to hear about some of the places you've hunted as far as like maybe a vacation with your dogs and, you know, bucket list places you want to go, or where's like something, species you've killed, stuff like that.
I've been fortunate for the work that I've been doing for the last 30 years to be able to incorporate hunting and fishing into, you know, my work. So, I've been blessed to go to a lot of places that I ordinarily wouldn't have gone. Like, always wanted to hunt pheasant in South Dakota, did that. I have been going to New Brunswick, Canada for 20 years. That started a long time ago when the woodcock limits dropped from 5 to 3 birds, and then the season was shortened from 45 days to 30 days. So New Brunswick woodcock season opens September 15th. So I would start, you know, just looking for ways to extend the season. And since I started going up there, it reminds me of what New England was like in the 1950s when, you know, you had a lot of farms that were reverting, you know, like that Bert Spiller, Corey Ford era that I've read about, when the pasture land was reverting to primary and secondary growth. So I like New Brunswick a lot. We hunt in New Hampshire for the entire month of October and the first week in November, because, you know, we work remotely. So as long as I have an internet connection, I'm able to work from wherever. So we'll do that. I've been, you know, also blessed that my wife's from the South. So I've hunted in Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, for quail, but I haven't been finding many wild quail. So I've been looking at woodcock down there for the last 5-6 years, and that's been a lot more fun. I've never hunted southwestern quail like Mirans. So I'd like to do that. Never been to Montana. Would love to hunt prairie birds.
Sure.
Would love to get to, you know, being out here on the coast, we shoot a lot of sea ducks. And they're fun, but I'd love to go to Arkansas at some point. I hunted flooded timber once in North Carolina and just thought that was like a gas.
Yeah.
So
that's a bucket list thing for me as well. And I will bust chops to my buddies who invited me and then I couldn't go and they went without me. They're actually hunting right now down there in Arkansas, green flooded timber. And I just, you see it on TV or videos, and man, that is mallard duck shooting right there.
My friend bought a gravel pit for $500 and it was near a river. It was an abandoned gravel pit and there were a bunch of oaks in it and on one side in the back. And I said, why would you buy a gravel pit? And he's like, watch this. And he lined it and he planted some corn in the front and then pumped some water in from the river. And it was like the combination of upland and waterfowl hunting, because we're standing next to the oaks and the mallards are coming in and the woodies and the teal, and man, that was a hoot.
That's cool. Now do you have a duck dog?
I don't. We do swaps. Most of my buddies have Chesapeakes and we'll hunt with them, and then I'll swap out some upland trips. So down here, they'll run their dogs, and then they'll come up to New Hampshire, and I'll run my dogs.
When you say down here, what do you mean?
I live on Cape Cod.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, so we've got a marsh right behind the house that I could walk to and, you know, set out some deeks and jump shoot and but we also have, I live in the town of Wellfleet, so there's a Wellfleet Harbor and on the bay side. There's some great spots with a lot of eelgrass for brant. And then we've got old squaw, buffleheads, surf scoter, eider. So we'll hunt with their chessies down here, and then when we go to New Hampshire, we'll hunt with my dog. So we just do a swap, and it works out great.
That's so cool. Selfish plug real quick. We just bred a Chesapeake that I trained. Her name is Ember, and I don't own her. My buddy does. And so if you know anybody looking for a good chessie, and hopefully, God willing, she's pregnant, but they're going to be – If one dog that wasn't my own, I love her to death. Unbelievably talented young dog. We did she passed the Master National. She was the youngest Chesapeake at Master National to pass.
I will keep my ears open.
Yeah, thank you. But anyways, yeah, so that's pretty cool. So I like to do one duck or hunting trip a year. And this year we went to Florida for redheads and didn't shoot a single redhead. We shot mergansers, basically. It was kind of a wash, but it was the camaraderie that made it. And we were actually kidding around like, man, you know, I just love spending time with you guys, but I wish we were killing ducks.
Right.
You know, but I feel like when you're in the uplands, you know, how are you scouting new areas you've never been? To some of the younger crowd that listen and either want to get into it or, you know, it's their first dog and they're struggling to find cover, what are you looking for in an area you've never been? How are you finding cover?
I do it the old-fashioned way. I've got topo maps and boots on the ground. So I'll take the topo maps. The only modern tool that I'll use is Google Earth, which I've found to be helpful. And I do most of my winter is spent looking for, you know, picking up a topo map, starting with the areas that I have, and then looking for patterns that would be similar in a different area. And I'll kind of highlight those areas on a topo map. Then I'll get onto Google Earth and look for two different things. One is access, you know, is it easy to get into? Can I see any houses? Are there, you know, buildings, etc.? And then I'll take a drive up and put the dogs down, knock on doors for permission. My alcohol bill in October is through the roof because I pass out bottles of whatever the landowners that let me hunt their properties drink. And I look for clear cuts. The state used to provide areas where they had timbered, and I look for the time of somewhere between 8 and 30 years of when it's been logged, because that'll show that that's when you're getting that primary and secondary growth. I'll visit lumber mills. They've been real helpful because they're processing the wood, and they'll tell me where it came from, and they'll give me a general idea. Always grease them with a bottle of booze because, you know, they're a wealth of information. You know, there's some of the other maps. I haven't gotten onto Onyx, but I know a couple guys that have been using that because it shows logged areas, I guess. But most of it is top of map, Google, look for certain parallels that are similar to an area that I know is productive, and then, you know, head to that area and put some boots on the ground.
Sure. How many miles are you covering when you go out and do these things? Like, what's an average day for you?
Oh, a lot. I spend a lot. I spend more time scouting than I do hunting and running the dogs. You know, it's just how to, you know, it's just a process of elimination. You know, I've seen a lot of covers, you know, so you always look for the food source. You're always looking for, you know, you can, for grouse, you can listen for drumming grouse. You can find drumming logs with a lot of scat that are on them. But you're going to be looking for a mixture of greens, fruits, nuts, you know, so for hard mast, acorns and beech are common. For soft mast, you're going to look for raspberries, high bush cranberries, Concord grapes.
Look for old apple trees.
Apples, you know, I've found to be, I always look for the apples, like you said, but I have rarely found a lot of grouse and the apples in the last probably 15, 18 years. But I always look for them. What I have noticed is that, you know, when you look at an apple tree, if you see that the whole bottom has been stripped and they're just apples at the top, you know that that's indicative of a bear that's just getting in and pawing them down. But I'll always check the apples to see if they've been pecked. But I've been seeing, you know, high bush cranberries have been more reliable in the last probably 5-6 years. You know, spearmint, wintergreen on the greens, clover, something that's near a field, you know, so like young aspen, young alder, young popple, that's near a field is always good. And that's where you'll get a mixture of grouse and woodcock.
That's
river
really cool.
Bottoms, you know.
Obvious water source.
Yeah, for water, if they've got seeps in them, if there's incongruous terrain. I've never hunted in the Great Lakes, but my understanding is that it's pretty flat. But I kind of like a rolling hill, you know. So it just, you know, you're looking for any kind of protection. You need to have some pines in there for the winter, and you know, in bad weather, because the grouse will roost, especially when it's snowing. You're going to need to have some catkins and buds. I ran into a woman about 30 years ago, and she told me that she was a farmer in New Hampshire. Her husband died. She was probably in her 80s. And she said the secret ingredient is black locust, and that you need 5 black locust per grouse, and that's what gets them through the winter. And I found that to be reliable.
Really?
Yeah, because they're budding.
In the winter.
Yep. That's, right. You know, because there's no ground forage.
Right. That's interesting. We were talking about that with Nick the other day when we were hunting. And I forget what tree he was saying, but it wasn't black locust. But he was saying there was some tree that in the dormant time of winter is popping buds and they're eating that.
I think he was saying quaking aspen.
Yep.
Yeah.
Sumac's another good winter forage. Crab apples are, that's another fruit that I miss that I found more grouse in the crab apples than the apples.
Cool. Well, that's all good information. All right. Another sidebar change discussion. Tom, you've alluded to it that you've written, but tell people what your day hustle, your day job besides chasing grouse and scouting is.
My wife and I own a marketing company called The Cure Group, and it's kind of a combination of all of our careers. I started off, went to grad school thinking that I wanted to be a college English professor and realized that I preferred to write. But I had a lot of debt from undergraduate and then graduate work. So I went to work for an advertising and PR agency in Boston and, you know, was working 7 days a week, 15 hours a day, was making some money, paid off my bills, but just really didn't like it. So I quit and was writing full time at that point. And then, went from making a lot of money to making no money. And
it's like being a dog trainer.
I just created a joke last week, and I said, I think that the modern freelance writer makes less money than the dog trainer. then I went to work for Orvis and worked there for 15 years and, you know, wound up running the wholesale division, which was basically everything except it was Canada, the United States, the Bahamas, all box stores, all brick and mortars, all OEM, which is private label stuff. So I worked with Walmart, Cabela's, Bass Pro. And just, you know, I was on the road 300 days a year, and I finally, you know, met my wife and just said, you know, I don't see myself doing this, being on the road and for 300 days a year. So what about this? Let's start our own company, and we'll take advertising, public relations, branding, marketing. And she's excellent with IT. She's a creative designer too. And we've got 6 employees now, and we just work in verticals. So it's all hunt fish. We work with lodges, small to medium sized manufacturers, large manufacturers, and it's been a lot of fun, and it's really been a blessing because we've got 2 kids and we're able to raise them with me being home more and, you know, having dinner together every night.
Good for you.
Are you able to travel with it being real hunt and fishing kind of a business? Are you able to go and experience the lodge before you do a little advertising? That'd be written into the contract if I were you.
You know... We got a call. So the answer is yes, and it resulted from this bizarre call that we had a bunch of years ago where I answer the phone and this guy screams and says, "Have you ever heard of Max Bow Hardcore?" And I was like, "Max Bow Hardcore?" And I was like, and I remembered hearing about it. And I was like, "Is that AI deer?" And he's like, "We got Max Bow Hardcore." And it was, you know, one of these high fence programs.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, well, I'd really got to come down and see your facility before we start working together, just to make sure that we're all on the same page here. But before I do that, can you tell me how you guys hunt? And he goes, "Oh yeah, we get a guide. We put a client in the blind And when the deer come out, you know, I give them a menu and I say, that one over there, a green score at about 180, and that's going to cost you $8,000. And the one behind him, it looks like he's about 220, and he's going to cost $25,000. And I said, and then what do you do? And he goes, well, then I, you know, take my four square and swipe his credit card, and if it clears, I tell him to take the shot.
No shit.
Yeah, and I said, I don't think that we're the right company for you. But no, we have worked with a lodge out in Colorado that had – it was a fishing and hunting lodge, the High Lonesome Ranch, and the K-Bar-T that was a fishing lodge in Meeker, Colorado. Deepwater K that was in the Bahamas, we relaunched that. It was a commercial bone fishing operation that then became a private club. It was founded in 1957.
Really?
By AJ McLean. And you know, and then it wound up becoming a private club that went into foreclosure, and then some new owners bought it, and that was a relaunch of that property, that's a super cool bonefish operation. They were just impacted by the storm.
I was just gonna say, how are they faring now?
They had about 60% devastation from the last hurricane.
Jesus.
So rebuilding again.
Yeah. Do you happen to have any good customers up in Alaska during the salmon season?
No, but I should, you know,
you got time. You gotta start hammering the phones and find somebody.
Yeah, they're all pretty full off during salmon season. They have been, you know, we talked to a couple of them a bunch of years ago, and they were looking to fill up the ecotourism, which we don't do much with, you know, like whale watches and, you know, photojournalistic, you know, trips.
Right. Well,
we had a couple of Maine grouse woodcock, landlocked salmon and brook trout lodges. We had a plantation in northern Florida, quail operation in North Carolina, pheasant operation in South Dakota.
That's awesome.
Have you been
to
the Salmon River? Here in New York, have you been to the Salmon River?
I've been there a couple times, yeah.
I was just fishing the Douglaston yesterday.
How'd you do?
Hiked in about a mile and froze my tail off, and the guy next to me caught four steelhead, and I don't think he heard me muttering anything under my breath, but he might have. But I had a good time. It was good.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a good time.
That's a neat area.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. And it was, I mean, I guess I joked, hiked a mile in, but I really did, through a cornfield. And it was just a pretty unbelievable little area.
Very cool. Kevin's father-in-law is a renowned fly fishing guy, like inducted into the Hall of Fame and all that jazz. And we didn't grow up fly fishing. We trout fished and bass fished and all that stuff, but he's taking Kevin under his wing, and they get to do a decent amount of it up there.
Fran.
Yeah. Yeah, we actually chatted about it. It's nice. Yeah, I get to, he's been showing me a bunch of stuff on tying flies, and it's been a good time.
I think that's really cool.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and then he also has lots of friends that have been tying flies for, you know, 50 years and this and that, and know people who started building the first rods, and just there's a lot of history, especially up in our area, as you're very well aware of. So it's just really interesting to meet all the different people, and I don't know, pretty cool.
Well, you're in a great part of the world. You got, you know, we used to have a goose lease in Canandaigua probably about 25 years ago before all the, you know, resident geese started staying here for the winter.
Yeah.
And that was a lot of fun. And Montezuma, you guys are close to Montezuma, right?
Yep. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's probably 40-minute ride, maybe? 35-minute ride?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah,
we're very fortunate to, you know, I think a lot of people don't look at New York State as a duck hunting place, and we all dream of Arkansas and Oklahoma and Kansas, but we truly are, you know, fortunate with all the farmland and corn and the Finger Lakes and Montezuma and all the money that DU has put into it. You know, we do well. I mean, this year has been a little slow, but overall we do well.
And you've got a serious concentration of Canada geese, which is a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That shooting geese over water is one of my favorite things to do.
It's like a cannonball flying out of the air.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. We are fortunate. So,
yep.
Do you have anything upcoming this year that you're excited about for hunting, or are you kind of winding down?
We're heading to my in-laws in North Carolina at the end of the month, and I'll spend probably about a week looking for some quail. So I'm excited about that. I'm real excited about working with this puppy. He's coming along, and I think he's probably going to be one of the best dogs I've ever had. So
wow.
I'm pretty psyched about that. And just starting to line up the fall. Kind of at that age where, you know, you brought up the bucket list question before, and I've always wanted to hunt in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and in Michigan, you know, before I get too old and can't get through the woods as well as I am right now. So I'm kind of thinking about doing that and looking at southwestern quail for next January.
Good for you. Good for you. Will you be, by any chance, going to Pheasant Fest?
You know, I've been back and forth on Pheasant Fest. I don't think I will go this year. I'm definitely not going to Shot. Done that a lot. It's so probably not. But okay. That is a great show. Are you going?
This is going to be my first year, yep.
That's a wonderful show.
Yeah.
They do such a great job.
That's a great organization. I'm going to go with Yukonuba and bring my dog with me. And so it'll be great to meet people and support Yukonuba at their event, you know, there and at their booth. But, you know, I haven't been to it. So to me, it's just going to be an experience.
You'll fit right in. Just a bunch of dog guys and dog gals that love to hunt.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Tom, can you, we're going to wrap this thingy up because I know it's getting late. Tell everybody where they can find you. You are a writer and you write for all the big magazines and your media group. You know, how, if someone wants to work with you or bring you in on a project, how can they find you?
So, our company web, our marketing company website is The Keer Group, thekeergroup.com. And my writing website is tomkeer.com.
Kevin, write that down. We need bobowens.com.
You should.
Yeah, that would be awesome. That's badass. That is badass. Now, actually,
probably
quick,
give it away for free, so don't worry about it.
That's true. You did write a book, right, back in the day?
Yeah, I wrote a book for Wilderness Adventures Press. It was a saltwater destination book on fishing in New England, which did not cover Connecticut. So it was Rhode Island, Massachusetts, Martha's Vineyard, Nantucket, Cape Cod, the sliver of coastal New Hampshire, and southern and central Maine.
Cool. Wow. Everybody, give him a shout, give him a check out, and if you're interested in learning more about Tom, head to his website. Tom, thank you for joining us. I really enjoyed listening to your dog knowledge and grouse knowledge and just learning more about you. Thank you for joining the podcast, and is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I just really appreciate you guys taking the time out of your busy schedules and having me on your show, so thank you very much for it.
No, glad to have you.
Hey, if you haven't done it already, jump into patreon.com/LoneDuckOuters if you enjoy the show and want to support the show. If this show has helped you and your dog grow together, if you enjoy our Instagram, if we've helped you at all, it's like buying me and Kevin a beer, and you get more one-on-one from me. You get content that doesn't hit Instagram or YouTube, and it enters you to win a free hunt with me and Kevin in Missouri this duck season. So jump on, links in the description. We'd be happy to have you and love to help you.
Hey listeners, Nick Larson here, host of the Birdshot Podcast. As fans of this show, you may be interested in the conversations on the Birdshot Podcast, where we discuss all things upland hunting, from upland birds and their habitat and conservation, to the shotguns, bird dogs, and gear used to pursue them. Whether you're a seasoned upland hunter or just getting started and wanting to learn more, I interview a wide range of guests, each with their own unique perspective and valuable experience to share. If you're on the hunt for more upland hunting conversation, please consider subscribing to the Birdshot Podcast today. We'll be right back.